स्मः नमः ॐ विष्णुपादाय कृष्णप्रेष्ठाय भूतले श्रीमते भक्तिवेदान्त स्वामी इति नामिने नमस्ते सारस्वती देवे गौरवाणी प्रचारिणे निर्विशेष शून्यवादी पाश्चात्यदेशतारिणे वाञ्छाकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्य एव च अतीतानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः जय श्री कृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभो नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैत गदाधार श्रीवासादि गौरभक्तवृन्द हरे कृष्णा 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 हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे
Hare Krishna. So today we have with us His Grace Chaitanya Charan Prabhu. So Chaitanya Charan Prabhu has done his engineering in electronics and telecommunication from Government College of Pune. After his graduation, Prabhuji has worked as a software engineer in multinational company. Prabhuji has been a topper in all over Maharashtra in GRE exam. Seeing the lack of spirituality, he felt inspired to dedicate his wife in the mission of Srila Prabhupada under the aegis of ISKCON. Currently, Prabhuji is a member of ISKCON's topmost intellectual body called as the Shastric Advisory Council. Prabhuji is also an associate editor of ISKCON International Magazine called as Back to Godhead. Prabhuji conducts various seminars at various institutions like IITs and NITs. Prabhuji has presented many international papers at the international conferences. Prabhuji also runs a cyber magazine called as spiritualscientist.com, where he has published around 200 articles for logical explanation of Vedic philosophy. He has written over 600 Gita meditation. Prabhuji's articles are very famous and has been published in leading newspaper like Times of India, Hindustan Times. Prabhuji is author of 11 very famous and popular books, in which few are Why Do We Need Temple, Oh My God. And Prabhuji today will be inspiring us by his class on the glories of Lord Varaha. So let us welcome His Grace Chaitanya Charan Prabhu loudly chanting 3 times. Hari Bol, Hari Bol, Hari Bol.
So I welcome all of you today afternoon to this discussion in the Dashavatar series on Varaha Dev. So I'll take this class in 2 parts. In the first part, I'll focus on the philosophical significance of the form of Varaha Dev. And in the second part, we'll talk about the pastimes of Varaha Dev as are described in the Srimad Bhagavatam. Sometimes people ask this question, does God exist? Now, every question requires some understanding of definitions. If I ask a question, is a circle circular? It's a meaningless question, isn't it? A circle, by its very definition, is circular. So, when a question is asked, is a circle circular? That basically means the person does not understand what a circle means. Only when a person does not know the definition of circle, can the person ask, is a circle circular? Similarly, when people ask, does God exist? They don't have an understanding of what God means. Now, if we think of God as, say, some being that some people believe in, some image in a temple, some person who had come time some long time ago, and some people believe him as God, then we may get this question naturally. Yes, does God exist or does God not exist? But if we actually understand what is the definition of God, the definition of God is Sarva Karana Karanam, the cause of all causes. The cause of all causes means that point from which everything began. And when we recognize this definition of God, then we understand that God is not a portion of existence. Portion of existence means, say the world exists and that one portion is, say, Antarctica. Now, if nobody has gone to Antarctica, they may say that Antarctica does not exist. Or some people talk about lost continent called Atlantis. They may say, oh, did this continent exist, did it not exist? People may have, when something is a portion of existence, that may be a portion which is actual, or it might just be an imagination. Somebody might imagine that something like this exists. But God is not a portion of existence. God is the source of existence. God is the basis of existence. Natadasti vinayatsyan maya bhutam characharam yachapi sarva bhutanam bijam tadaham arjuna. In 10.39 in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna says that whatever exists, I am the seed of it all. Nothing can exist without me. So if we go back, now all of us, we exist. We come from our parents. Our parents come from their grandparents. Our grandparents come from their grandparents. This seat on which I am sitting, this is made of wood. This wood comes from some tree. That tree comes from ancestor tree. Now like this, if we go backward, 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 wherever we stop, that point would be the absolute truth. Would be God as is explained in the Vedic, in the Bhakti tradition. So now, when we consider this, but even if we look at it from a, if somebody is skeptical, somebody is atheistic, even they have to confront the question, where did everything come from? There's an atheist who has written a book, How Everything Came from Nothing. And now if we read that book, actually the whole book essentially is not an explanation of how everything came from nothing. It is essentially a redefinition of nothing, so that nothing is something from which everything can come out. So the nothing from which everything is supposed to come out, that is basically a complex quantum mechanical vacuum that requires pages upon pages of intricate triple integral calculus to describe. That nothing is certainly not nothing. So if we move backwards, we see in this world there is consciousness. And we can understand that whatever is the source, that also must have had consciousness. Otherwise, how would consciousness manifest over here? So if the source has had to have consciousness, the basic difference between a materialistic worldview and a spiritual worldview is, in the material worldview, the idea is, from less comes more. Whereas from the spiritual worldview, the idea is, from more comes less. From less comes more means, oh, originally, there was just a random matter, there was just a primeval soup, and somehow some lightning struck, and whatever. And how would it all come about? Oh, ultimately there was just a quantum mechanical vacuum, whatever it is. And where did that come from? That has no answer ultimately. So the point is that from originally there was disorder, and from that order has emerged. Now how did order emerge? That is something which is, there are certain mechanisms which skeptics may propose. Here I am differentiating skeptics from scientists, because not all scientists are atheists. Science has a particular way of approaching nature, and it does not talk about God. Just as if I have a black and white TV, nowadays practically nobody has black and white TVs, but if suppose we had black and white TV, then no matter how much effort I may put in, I cannot see a color image on a black and white TV, no matter what I do. So like that, science focuses on approaching reality in material terms. And because God is not material, science itself can neither prove nor disprove the existence of God. So atheists sometimes try to misappropriate the prestige and power of science to prop up their worldview. But science is basically a tool for acquiring knowledge. And it is a particular kind of tool by which some things can be seen, some things can't be seen. So when we understand that everything needs to have a source, and then because there is consciousness present here, there has to be consciousness present in the source. So when we understand this point, and that source of everything, that source is defined as God. That source is the absolute truth. So when somebody asks, does God exist? If we actually understand God means existence, the basis of existence, the source of existence, the one without whom nothing would exist, then the question, does God exist, is understood to be actually incoherent. It is. So rather than trying to answer the question, does God exist, we need to ask people, what is your definition of God? When you say God exists or does not exist. So now in the different traditions of the world, there have been different conceptions of God. So there is the reality of God as the source of everything. And when that reality is revealed to us, we understand it in particular ways. So Bhaktivinoda Thakur, a prominent Vaishnava Acharya, he writes in his book Chaitanya Shikshamrit, say the absolute truth is like a peak, like a mountain peak. And that same one mountain peak was seen by Plato from the west, and it was seen by Patanjali from the east. That same one absolute truth was seen by Lao Tzu from the north, and it was seen by others from various directions. So it's the same one absolute truth. So there is the reality of God, and there is the concept of God, or there is a conception of God. Conception means how one is able to think of, how one is able to perceive, how one is able to conceptualize. And God is always greater than the human capacity for conception. That God, whatever we can understand, God is always greater than that. Now because God is so great, so some people argue that actually God cannot be known. They say God is infinite. God is infinite, and suppose if we depict God, through stone, or we even describe God's form in scripture, through text. Any form that we ascribe to God, that form is limited. And because God is unlimited, any ascribed form to God is actually a misunderstanding. And if especially people come up with, when they encounter the wide variety of conceptions of God or depictions of God that come up in the bhakti tradition, then they often find it very difficult to understand. So for example, the forms like Matsya Avatar. So Matsya Avatar is actually a fish. Now Varaha Avatar, about whom we'll be discussing, the background we are discussing right now, Varaha is actually he is not just a boar. He has a boar with human features. He has a human face and he walks erect. So it's like a human being. So this avatar is sometimes called as zoomorphism. So anthropomorphism means to anthropos is human, zoo is animal. So zoomorphism means to ascribe an animal form to God. Anthropomorphism is to ascribe a human form to God. And these are the ideas that people get. Oh, this is some people in the past, you know, they thought that, oh, God, you know, God is the biggest of all beings. So maybe they imagined God to be the biggest of all beings. So they thought that God must be a giant lion. Lion is the king of animals. So maybe they thought of God as a lion, giant animal, giant lion. But then, if we look at this notion, this idea, there is, first let's look at, deconstruct this one by one. The idea that God, does he have a form, does he not have a form? Does form limit God? Actually, yes, we could say that form limits God. But then the other end of it is that if we say God does not have a form, God is just energy, God is just a presence, then by saying that God does not have something, form, we are also limiting God. Isn't it? Suppose there is a house. The house is limited. Suppose there's a bomb and there's a demolition squad which comes and it blows up the house. After the house is blown up, the form as we see it is destroyed. So the form is destroyed, has that house now become unlimited? No, the house is still limited. So, whether with form or without form, the house is still limited. So what causes limitation is not form. What causes limitation is matter. Matter, whether it is with form or without form, it is limited. So another way of arguing is that, oh God, if you ascribe form to God, He will be limited. Another problem with this argument is, okay, you may say God is so big that we can't conceive Him. He is infinite. Okay, we may say He is infinite. We now when we talk about 1 plus 1 plus 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. So, at what point does this list become infinite? Now, it becomes infinite when we can't count. Okay, but infinity minus 1 will still say infinity. Infinity minus 2 is still infinity. So, if we can't conceive God at all, then how can we say that He is inconceivable? To say that God is unknowable also is a claim to know that God is unknowable. To make any statement, oh, He is so big that you can't see Him. Well, you must be able to see Him to know that He is so big that you can't see Him. Otherwise, how can you know that He is so big? So any state of even negative, God is not like this. That is also a claim to knowledge of God. Bhaktivinoda Thakur has written a book called Jaiva Dharma, in which he gives a depicts a discussion between a skeptic. He says, why do you need to depict God in a material form? Why don't you just think of God? So Bhaktivinoda Thakur gives a reply on the through a Vaishnava Acharya who is speaking. He says, but even your thoughts are material. When we think, how are we thinking right now? We are using our brain. The soul is there, but the soul is right now thinking using the mind and the body, the brain. So at right now, our consciousness is at the material level. So even our thoughts are material. So if we say because God is non-material, we can't depict Him, then we should not be able to think of Him also. So it's not that God is not conceivable. Now, in the Western traditions, they have certain categories about what God is. They have brought two broad categories, monotheism and polytheism. So monotheism is the idea that there is monotheism, one God. And this is the idea of the three primary Abrahamic religions, Judaism, Christianity and Islam. And before this, especially before Christianity started spreading in Middle East and Europe, it originated in Middle East and spread in Europe. Before that, there was the Greco-Roman tradition, which had many gods. And that was their idea of polytheism. They said polytheism is very primitive. Well, why is polytheism primitive? Because, you know, if God is supreme, then how can there be many supremes? There should be only one supreme. And when they had that idea of polytheism, and the Western people came to India, and they found that, oh, India has also so many different gods. And this is also polytheism. But then they found that actually, it's not polytheism, because if we see, whatever descriptions of God, the characteristics of God, the basic characteristics. For example, Aham Adishcha Madhyam Cha Bhutanam Antayeva Cha. Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, I am the beginning, the middle and the end of all things. And in the Bible it is said that I am the Alpha and the Omega of all things. So, Aksharanam Akarosmi. I am the letter A among alphabet. So, Krishna, if you look at the attributes of God that are described in the Bhagavad Gita and the attributes of God that are described in the Bible, they are broadly similar. So the Bhagavad Gita is depicting a God, one God who is supreme. So it is clearly like a monotheistic God. But there are so many different forms. So the problem is, sometimes we approach something with certain preconceived frameworks. And when something doesn't fit into our preconceived framework, then we try to reduce reality down to that. So, you know, if say I draw a map of Mumbai. Or if say we draw a map of Australia. Say Australia is a continent. We draw a map of, and we come to the edge of Australia, but there is no edge. Still there is land. So now if I experience that there is territory beyond my map, what should I do? I need to change my map. But I say, no, this territory doesn't exist only. If I am too attached to the map, then what happens? I try to change the reality to fit the map. But the reality is meant to depict the map. The reality is not going to change according to the map. So similarly, there are this mental map people have. There is either polytheism or there is monotheism. But the Vedic scriptures go, the bhakti conception goes beyond this categorization. You know, it is, the bhakti conception is not either polytheism or monotheism. Actually, it is polymorphic monotheism. Polymorphic morpho means form. Poly means many. Advaita machyuta manadi manantarupam. That actually, there is one God who manifests in many forms. And not only polymorphic monotheism, actually there is one God, and there are many other devatas through whom, who are intermediaries. If you cannot approach that one supreme God, we can worship the devatas. So it is multi-level polymorphic monotheism. And not only that, actually, there is not just one God, there is a God as a divine couple. And it is Radha Krishna ek atma dui deha dhari. It is one soul who is manifested in two bodies. So actually, it is not just monotheism, it is one God manifesting in two forms. So it is bi-monotheism. So the Vedic, the bhakti conception of God is multi-level polymorphic bi-monotheism. So actually, we need a proper philosophical background to appreciate what is happening. So this is the broad understanding of God. Now coming to the specific form of, say, we are discussing about Varaha Dev. So Varaha Dev is a manifestation of God in a very unlikely form. Whichever tradition it is in, a boar is considered to be maybe a dangerous animal. But a boar is usually not considered a special or a worshipable animal. And paradoxically, you know, there are different avatars which are associated with different things. So now Varaha Dev is associated with yajna. Actually, yajna is an activity in which a huge amount of purity is required. And normally speaking, if any animal comes in the precincts of a yajna, the yajna is considered to be defiled. So, why is it that Varaha Dev is considered to be the form of the Lord associated especially with yajna? That's to convey that actually this is not an ordinary form. This is a transcendental form. And the special purpose, the special significance of the manifestation of the Lord as Varaha is to convey that God remains transcendental even when He comes in a form which might seem to be very contaminated, which might not seem to be at all attractive. So even when somebody comes in such a form, that person is actually still that Lord still remains transcendental. So one of the devotee leaders in our movement is Airavat Prabhu. He was from a Muslim background. And when he was young, all young people usually they are rebellious. So once he was attaining in the Middle East, he was attaining a class on Quran by Mullah. And then just out of skepticism he asked, so you say Allah, if Allah is everywhere, is he there in stool? So the Mullah got so angry. He says, oh, you are blaspheming Allah. Get out of here. Get out of here. So he just walked out. He just walked out of the mosque at that time. He just walked out of religion. And then he was intelligent. He went to America. He got education there. And usually people who come from cultures that are conservative, when they go into Western cultures, often they become hedonistic. So like that, he indulged in a lot of partying. Once he was in a party and he drank so much that he fell unconscious in the party itself. So the other people, they did not know who he was. They just took him and dumped him into a sort of, there was near the party hotel, there was a godown. Just dumped him over there. And he just came back and he was just groggy and he looked around and you know, it's dark, where am I? And he saw there was some light from somewhere. And that light was falling on a book. And that book was looking very shiny. So I was still, and he just looked. And then he looked at the book, he went, got up, and he says, somehow he was attracted to the book. He saw that God is present everywhere, even in stool. So that was actually a back to Godhead. So he was shocked, what is this? He picked up the book and he read it. And the article explained how actually God is transcendental. You know, he is not affected by anything material. The material things contaminate us when we are at the material level of consciousness. But because he is transcendental, nothing affects him. So he was so stunned. He had just been partying and then he had fallen asleep. So he just looked around at that time itself. You know, who is this? He looked at the background, at the back of the back to Godhead, there are the addresses of the temples. So he looked, where is the temple? And then at that time only, as he was still recovering from the drunkenness, but he was so excited. So he's right, then only he went to the temple. And he came to the temple, and at that time everybody was rushing for Mangal Aarti. So he said, hey, I heard that God is everywhere, he's even stool also. He says, what? You know, imagine somebody just comes in the morning, everybody is rushing for Mangal Aarti. What is this? He said, I want to know a little bit about this. Now they look, everybody look whether he's just teasing or making fun. He said, no. He says, okay, you come with us. And then he came and he came to the temple, and when he came to the Mangal Aarti, it was just a sublime experience for him. So he just became, then he stayed on and he understood the philosophy. And now he's one of the, he is a prominent preacher who especially explains the bhakti conception in the Islamic world. So, actually, many times, many people turn away from God, it is because the conception of God which they come along, they encounter, that does not answer their questions. So, sometimes people say that if you have to believe in God, you have to believe in religion, you have to stop asking questions. Just believe. Now, atheist caricature religion, as they say that, religion means what? You just become brainwashed. You say, pay, pray, obey. That is their idea of religion. But, if you consider bhakti is not about that. Bhakti is actually analyze, realize and relish. Bhakti gives us, first of all, philosophy. Vimrishaita dasheshina itichitaha karu. Krishna tells Arjuna, deliberate. The whole Bhagavad Gita is essentially question answers. The Upanishads are question answers. The Puranas are question answers. It is not just a call for blind faith. Analyze. Then, it is not just analyze and speculate, but there is a process to raise one's consciousness. There is a process to realize higher reality. And then when we realize, and as we realize more and more, then we relish. So it's a awakening of a higher mode of perception that happens by the practice of bhakti. So the different religions do talk about God, but quite often the conception of God that is there is quite unclear. The bhakti tradition offers us a conception that is multichrome. You know, it is vivid. Clear graphic conception of God, and with this conception it is easy to appreciate God and to adore God. Now when we come to Varaha Dev, the point is the Krishna, when he descends as Varaha Dev, the Supreme Lord demonstrates that actually whatever happens, he remains uncontaminated. He is always transcendental. In fact, a similar question is asked later, that in the 8th canto, when the Matsya Avatar Leela is being described at that time, Parikshit Maharaj asks the same question, Jugupsitam Rupam, why is it that the Supreme Lord is designed in a form which is not at all attractive? So he says, the Lord is transcendental. That's what Parikshit Maharaj's answer is given, the answer by Shukadeva Goswami. Now, what does transcendental mean? There are two broad conceptions of God's relationship with matter. One idea is that God is completely beyond matter. That is referred to as transcendence. And there is another idea that God is present within matter. And that is called as immanence. So God beyond matter is transcendence. God within matter is immanence. Now, when we say that Krishna is transcendental, the deity is transcendental, the the holy name is transcendental. What does that mean? That means that although God is manifesting here within matter, but He is not matter. He is Himself transcendental. He manifests through matter, but He remains transcendental. So the Supreme Lord can manifest in whichever form He wants, but He is not affected by that form. Circumstantially, of course, there is a reason. Just like Narasimha Dev, he manifests also that he is in a transcendental form. And there is a circumstantial reason why he manifests in that particular form. That is, Satyam Vidhatum Nijabhritya Bhashitam. Satyam Vidhatum. That he to demonstrate the truth of the words of his servant. Now that can refer to Narad Muni had promised that Prahallad will be protected. Brahmaji had promised that no being created by me will be able to kill you. And Prahallad had said, yes, Vishnu is present even in this pillar. So all these three words, the Lord kept true by manifesting in a form of Narasimha Dev. So like that, when Varaha Dev manifests, he manifests in this form for a particular purpose. And that is, to understand that, we have to look at the background. Now this was the philosophical background, what the form of Varaha Dev signifies. And now, let's look at the chronological background. What happened? So, there were these two demons, Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu. They were born of the of Diti. So they are called as Daityas. The sons of Diti are called as Daityas. The sons of Aditi are called as Adityas. The Bhagavatam, from the third canto onwards, till the first and the second cantos in the Bhagavatam, it is setting up the scene and creating the background for the main conversation. The conversation starts. Conversation between Parikshit Maharaj and Prahlad, Parikshit Maharaj and Shukadev Goswami starts by the end of the first canto. And in the second canto, there are various discussions that happen. And some basic conceptions of God are talked about. And at that time, Shukadev Goswami is about to walk away. So Parikshit Maharaj asks a question at that time. Please describe the various incarnations of the Lord and please describe how they manifest during the course of the universe. And from the third canto onwards, till the 11th canto end, the Bhagavatam thereafter is a description of one day of Brahma within the history of the universe. So what happened in the beginning, what happened thereafter, that is being described. So the third canto, the universe, its cosmos is divided into manvantaras. So third canto to the seventh canto describes the first manvantara, that is Swayambhu Manu. Then quickly seven manvantaras are described in the first chapter of the eighth canto. And from the eighth chapter till the twelfth chapter, so the eighth canto to twelfth canto, the Vaivasvat manvantara's incidents are described, which is the current manvantara going on. So how Krishna appeared, that is also described there. So this event of the appearance of Varaha takes place right at the beginning of the universe. Now, Jiva Goswami has analyzed the Bhagavatam very painstakingly. Rupa Goswami has also written a book, which could practically be called the book of the science of avataras. What are the different avataras? What is their nature of their manifestation? What is their purpose? So that is called the Laghu Bhagavatamrita. And therein, both the Goswamis describe how actually there are two Varaha avatars. They appear at different times and they do different pastimes. So we will focus on the Varaha that is described in the Bhagavatam's third canto. So third canto, chapter 17, 18 and 19 describe Varaha Dev as he appears and he delivers the world from Hiranyaksha. So Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu. Hiranyaksha, the Aksha is eyes. Hiranyaksha, it can mean the eye of gold. But what it means functionally is that one who has an eye on gold. He's always eyeing for gold. He's always trying to see where is gold, where is gold, where is gold. And he wants to possess all the gold. Nowadays, oil is very important in the global geopolitics of the world. So anyone who controls the oil, then they control the world economy. Everybody else has to submit to them. So the powers that be try to capture the oil. So similarly, Hiranyaksha knew that gold is very significant, not just in terms of its wealth, but also in terms of its significance for ornamentation and for sacred activities. So he wanted to conquer all the gold. And within the universe, the earth was considered to be the place where there's a lot of gold. Now, at that time, he captured the earth. Now, he exploited the earth and that destabilized the earth. So, when he had destabilized the cosmic order, at that time, the devatas became very anxious. And when they became extremely anxious about how things will go on. Dharma is not just some religious rituals. Dharma actually refers to the underlying order of the universe. And the religious rituals that we perform, they are meant to harmonize us with the underlying order of the universe. So, here Hiranyaksha was destabilizing and destroying the order of the universe. And the devatas became very anxious. In fact, when he had been born itself, at that time there had been inauspiciousness everywhere. There had been signs of foretelling that there is going to be terribly wrong things happening. So there were storms, there were as if the stars were going in retrograde motion, and all these conveyed inauspiciousness. Now this inauspiciousness, or we call it apshakun, what does it signify? Basically, it is like a weather forecast. Now when there is weather forecast, now there are those who have a trained eye, they can say, okay, this means the clouds are moving this way, the wind is moving this way, that means rains are going to come. Now if the weather forecasters are experienced, they are expert, then a common person cannot see, but the weather forecasters can know that the weather is going to be like this. Just as we can have a weather forecast for the earth, similarly there are subtle forces in the universe which when understood, they can give the forecast of what is going to happen later. So even now, researchers have found that there are some things, there are some sources of information and there are some means of acquiring information that are just not comprehensible. In many places, whenever earthquakes occur, so before that, the animals start behaving in some peculiar ways. And this has been documented again and again. Now, how do the animals come to know that there is something going to happen? That there are earthquakes going to occur? So sometimes we are able to forecast weather reasonably well, but forecasting earthquakes with our seismic probes, it's still not a very well refined science. So there are attempts to now understand how animals are doing it, but still now it has just come to a dead end. We understand that they understand, but we don't understand how they understand. So there is more to the universe than what we can perceive with our senses or what we can conceive with our science. So the Bhagavatam talks about the universe from a different perspective. And the purpose of the Bhagavatam has to be understood. No, sometimes if we hear about the cosmology of the Bhagavatam, we may wonder, is this really true? How can it be true? Science talks about so many different things. Basically, the Bhagavatam's description of the cosmos and science description of cosmos, they are from different scales. Different scales of perception means, say for example, if I have chalk, white chalk, and I ground it into powder. And then I have coal, black coal, and I ground it into powder. Now I mix both of them together. When I mix both of them together, I will have grey powder. Now if I look at that same grey powder under a microscope, I won't see any grey powder. I'll see black granules and I will see white granules. Now what is it? Is it white granules and black granules, or is it grey powder? Actually what it is will depend on what scale we are perceiving. So our observation is intrinsically connected with our scale of observation. Now, we cannot observe, this is one of the fundamental postulations which has emerged from quantum physics, that the observed reality depends on the observer. So the Bhagavatam, I won't go into the technicalities here, but the Bhagavatam describes the universe from a different scale of observation. And modern science perceives the Bhagavatam from a different scale of observation. So Hiranyakashipu, so within the Bhagavatam scale of observation, it's a different way of looking at the world. And within its own worldview, there is a particular purpose, and that purpose is served by looking at the world in that way. Now, Hiranyaksha's exploiting the earth and conquering the gold resources that destabilizes the earth. And when the cosmic order is disrupted at that time, the devatas, they are already in panic. And then, they pray fervently, and at that time, this Hiranyaksha, he is drunk with power. He is drunk with ego. He says that, oh, there is no one to challenge me. So Hiranyaksha and Hiranyakashipu are both deadly brothers. But Hiranyakashipu will be described in the 7th canto. Here Hiranyaksha is right at the beginning of the universe. He just starts evoking a reign of terror everywhere. And nobody is able to fight with him. And because he's so powerful, people just concede the battle. And he is itching for a fight. So finally, he meets Narad Muni. Narad Muni tells him that, why are you fighting with all these lesser creatures? You know, you go to the ocean, there the Supreme Lord is there, and he will destroy your pride. So now, he will destroy your pride. When he hears this, Narad Muni is actually very expert. Now he says he will destroy your pride. When he says like this, it might seem very provocative, you know, he will defeat you. But Narad Muni knows that this is what, when he speaks like this, that will provoke him, and rather than going around creating more vandalism, he will immediately go and challenge Varahadev. So then he goes straight to the ocean. And there he sees this huge form. Now Hiranyaksha himself is a giant demon, and here there is a huge boar. And this boar, he says, hey, what is this? He expected some worthy opponent, and he says, what is the boar? But then he sees that this boar is actually restoring the earth to its proper position, is stopping or reversing the disruption that he is causing. And devatas cannot tolerate disorder. They want things to be orderly. The asuras cannot tolerate order. Wherever they see order, they want to disrupt everything. Vishnu Bhakta Smrito Deva Asurastha Viparyaya. So when he sees that Varahadev is restoring the order, he says that actually the earth has been entrusted to us. We have conquered earth. You cannot take the earth away just from me like that. So I will destroy you for encroaching on my property. So actually, the idea of the demons is possession is ownership. You know, if you possess something, that means you own it. But, yes, when we possess something, how long are we going to possess it? When we possess something, actually, we are stewards. We are not owners. Whatever it is that we have, it is in our care. It is not in our ownership. Ishavasya midam sarvam. So, Krishna owns everything ultimately. But here, so he challenges Varadev. And Varadev says, come out of the water. He says that actually now Varahadev plays along with him. Varahadev says, okay. He says, now that I have challenged a formidable enemy like you, I don't think there is any way I can escape. So I'll just stay in this water for some time. If you want to fight with me, you come here. And then Hiranyaksha will challenge, and he comes up and he has his mace, and Varahadev also produces his mace, and then he puts the earth on the side and he imbues the earth with his own mystic potency. And then the earth floats over there. Gama vishya bhutani dharayamyam ojasa pushnami chaushadhi sarva somo bhutva rasatmakaha. Gama vishya bhutani. Krishna says, I enter into the earth and I cause it to float. So float means, even now when it is moving around in space in its orbit, we may say it is moving about by gravity. But what is the source of gravity? That's source of gravity is ultimately the mystic potency of the Supreme Lord. So he keeps the earth safely, and after keeping the earth safely, he turns around. And Hiranyaksha starts attacking him. He whirls his mace and hits the Lord. And they start fighting. As they are fighting, both are expert. But one particular point, Hiranyaksha hits the mace of the Lord with such force that the mace just slips out of his hand. And as the mace slips out of his hand and falls on the ground, the devatas are observing. So actually, in the past, you know, the Kshatriya fights were a spectator sports. You know, people would watch eagerly because it was not, everybody understood that actually the soul is eternal. So the fight was a competition of skill. And they wanted the devatas to win. The devatas wanted Vishnu to win. And when they saw this, now Hiranyaksha, at that particular time, he was so confident that I am going to win. He says, not only do I want to win, he says, I want to win in a spectacular way. So he had the opportunity to hit Varahadev while his weapon had fallen down. But he chose not to hit. He chose not to hit him. And then Lord Vishnu appreciated that he had fought in the sportsman level, and then he was bending down to pick up his mace. At that time, Brahmaji and other devatas had been watching. So Brahmaji is often the intermediary between the devatas and Vishnu. So Brahmaji is the person who offers prayers and gets Vishnu to appear in this world. So now also he was appealing to Vishnu, and he said, "Oh Lord, please don't play with this demon. He is extremely dangerous, and there is the time of auspiciousness. And there is the time of inauspiciousness. So right now, the time of auspiciousness, it is called the Abhijit Murta, that Murta is still now going on. In this Murta, if you can kill him, it is good. Otherwise, as the time changes, his power will increase. And when his power increases, he will become more of a nuisance. So you have descended to this world to protect all of us, my dear Lord. Please don't play with him." Now, Brahmaji, as he speaks like this, at that time, Lord Vishnu, who is manifesting his Varaha form, he just looks at Brahmaji with eyes filled with affection. And he acknowledges his prayers. It's interesting that the Bhagavatam describes this as a boar. How does a boar look affectionately? But actually, this is not just a boar. He is the Lord manifesting in a boar form. And Brahmaji is a Brahmana. A Brahmana is one who is Brahma Janatiti Brahmana. One who understands what is spiritual reality, that is a Brahmana. And he understands that whatever form the Lord is manifesting him, he is still the Supreme Lord. Now, at this time, what is Hiranyaksha thinking about? Now, Hiranyaksha, does he really understand that this is Vishnu and I am trying to fight with Vishnu? Because when he normally thinks of Vishnu, he thinks of Vishnu in a particular form, a four-handed Shankha Chakra Gada Padma. And that's what, when Prahlad was worshipping Vishnu, and suddenly Narasimha Deva manifested, Hiranyakashipu could not make the connection. You know, who is this? Adrishta Purvam, he said, no, this form had never been seen before. So he just could not make a connection. He thought maybe this is some lion that has come. But as the fighting went on and Hiranyakashipu could not overcome Narasimha Deva, he started understanding this is not an ordinary person. But similarly, as the fighting had been going on, Hiranyaksha started developing doubts. Is this really a boar or is this Vishnu? But when he had just knocked down the mace, he felt, yes, I'm going to win. Whoever he is, I'm going to kill him. And I'm going to be victorious. But as he was waiting and Brahmaji was offering prayers, then for Hiranyaksha now it was confirmed that this is actually Vishnu. And his anger increased all the more. Now Lord Vishnu smiled at Brahmaji in his Varaha form, but then he still wanted to play on. So at that time, when Brahmaji was offering prayers, Lord Vishnu manifested Sudarshan Chakra. Sudarshan Chakra manifested, effulgent. And now when he saw the Sudarshan Chakra just flying, now the chakra of the Lord, actually, in the Vishnu Sahasranam, there's a commentary to it written by Baladeva Vidya Bhushan. And in that, he described that the chakra of the Lord represents time. Now, time is cyclic. And time is unstoppable. Time just keeps moving. So like that, the chakra of the Lord is unstoppable. So when he manifested the chakra, at that time, he understood. Hiranyaksha understood, this is really Vishnu. And the chakra of Vishnu is unstoppable. So he just picked up his, he saw that he is not taking up his mace. Then he put aside his mace and started charging towards charging towards Varahadev. And then Varahadev saw that he is not having any weapons. Lord Varahadev also put aside his chakra. He had the chakra, but he decided they are going to fight without weapons. They started fighting without weapons. And they started pounding each other. Pounding. And Hiranyaksha used all his strength and bat Varahadev. And Varahadev just smiled. The fight was going on. The demon was fighting in earnest. And it appeared as if also the Lord was fighting with earnest. But as they are fighting, the Lord just smiled as if, you know, an elephant is hit with a flower garland. Had no effect on him at all. Hiranyaksha was infuriated. And nothing happens. He kept attacking again and again. And the demons have mystic powers. So initially, when he had seen Varahadev, he had been suspicious. How can a boar be so big? He says, whoever you are using some mystic powers. Now, what does mystic powers mean? Mystic power means that, you know, there are certain powers which we have access to by our normal strength. But beyond what we have access to with our normal capacities, there is in the universe powers which are beyond. And those powers can be accessed by certain processes. So those powers are called as mystic powers. So, now there are different people who can have different levels of mystic powers. So he had such mystic power by which he suddenly was in front of Vishnu, Varaha, and suddenly he disappeared. And when he disappeared, the idea was, he realized that by a fair fight I can't win now. So he wanted to somehow or the other win, he started playing tricks. And then he started pounding Vishnu, but no matter whatever he was doing, Varaha was unaffected. And finally, after playing all his tricks, he realized that nothing is happening, he just appeared right in front of Varahadev. And he just decided to crush Varahadev in his arms and came charging forward to hold Varahadev in the grip. And he just went around and he found that Varahadev was just smiling, standing next to him. He turned around, tried to catch him, and Varahadev was next. Now Varahadev was basically paying him back in his own coin. Now Varahadev started exhibiting his supreme mystic power. And as this fight was going on and on, Hiranyaksha was becoming more and more infuriated. His body, as they were beating and pounding each other, Hiranyaksha's body was bleeding, he was getting exhausted. And he was getting exhausted on one side, he was getting infuriated on the other. And as this was going on, again Brahmaji prayed to Vishnu, "Oh Lord, please, don't play with this, please finish this." No, suppose a cricket match is going on, a very exciting cricket match, you know. And, you know, for 5 days, suppose a test is going on or a one-day match is going on. Throughout, it's a very closely contested match. And then, as the match is, you know, now say 5 overs are remaining or whatever. And now the match is going to come to its climax. And suddenly, one batsman comes and, you know, suddenly, hits 6 sixes and finishes the match. So it's a match which was a big, big contest. Suddenly, it becomes like a one-sided romp. So, Lord Vishnu is fighting with Varahadev, and Lord Vishnu is Varahadev is fighting with Hiranyaksha, and it's a fierce fight, and at one particular point, what does Varahadev do? He just touches Hiranyaksha on the head with a finger. Attack! Hiranyaksha just falls down, dead. Everything in just one moment, all that the Lord was doing was, he was simply playing. It is not that Vishnu has any difficulty in overcoming anyone. It is not that the demons are so powerful that God cannot defeat them. I'll conclude with this, a little philosophical explanation of what we mean by when the God fights. Why does he fight and how does he fight? There are some religions which say that there is good and there is evil in this world. And good and evil is in a fierce fight. And why are they all suffering in this world? Because evil triumphs over good. So that, and they say these forces are also eternal. Now there are some other religions say actually God is eternal, evil is not eternal, but evil is currently in control. Evil is currently in control. So this is the Christian explanation of evil. Say, why does God allow bad things to happen in this world when he's in control? They say God is not in control of this world. Satan is in control of this world. When Adam ate the forbidden apple, at that time Adam ceded control of the world to Satan. And Satan is also very powerful. And in the end, there will be a fight when God will defeat Satan. And at that time those who are faithful will be delivered. The Vedic understanding is, yes, there are forces of good and forces of evil. But God is beyond this good and beyond this evil. There is the higher planetary system, there is the middle planetary system, the lower planetary system. The higher are predominated with good, the lower are predominated with bad. But God is beyond the bad and beyond the good. He is transcendental. His abode is Vaikuntha, which is neither below nor above, it is beyond. Beyond this whole world. So, sometimes we have a very simplistic idea, you know. People have say, oh, when you die, you go to heaven. Where is heaven? Heaven is up. But then, the earth is round. So, up in America and up in India. They're opposite directions. So, where is up? So, that up, when we say, actually, when we say we go to God, that up is not a geographical up. That is a transcendental up. And that transcendental up is beyond the geography of this world. So we may use for normal conversation some terms which seem similar to what we normally discuss. But God is neither good nor bad. He is beyond good and bad. He is transcendental. And it is not that God is in a fight with evil. The evil in this world is there because people in this world act evilly. And sometimes they cause reactions. So there is moral evil, which means people act badly, and natural evil means nature acts badly, that is a reaction to the moral evil that people have done in the past. But the point is, God is always in control. You know, God is the cause of all causes, but He is not the cause of all effects. God is the cause of all causes. Just as whatever vegetation grows in a field, it all grows because rains are there. But the rain is not the cause of growing of weeds. The weeds grow because somebody did not plant anything over there. If somebody had planted something good, some harvest would have grown over there. So without the rain, nothing will grow. But the rain is not responsible for whatever specific thing that grows. So like that, God is the cause of all causes. Without Him, nothing would happen. But what happens in this world, He is not the cause of all the effects. All the evil that is there in the world, that is because people misuse their free will. So when God seems to fight, and seems to have a good fight, that is a leela. Leela means that God does not delight simply in His Godhood. You know, if God were simply, the only thing that God had to do was everybody would come down and bow down to Him. And that's the only thing that God does for all of eternity. You know, being God would be very boring. But God does not delight in His Godhood. Yes, this is His role. He accepts worship, as Prahlad Bara says, that he accepts worship for our benefit. But He, in His own abode, He conceals His Godhood for the reciprocation of love, for the performance of various pastimes. And one such pastime that He likes to perform is fighting. So at that time, He empowers certain demons so that they can fight with Him. So the demons, that's why when you see Prahlad has asked by Hiranyakashipu, what is the source of your strength? So he doesn't simply say, oh, the source of my strength is Vishnu. What does he say? He says, the source of my strength is also the source of your strength and is also the source of Brahma's strength. Who is the source of your strength? That means that although in the pastime, Hiranyaksha and Varahadev seem to be at two people at the same level fighting with each other. But actually, Hiranyaksha's strength also comes from Varahadev. And Hiranyaksha is given strength by Varahadev so that Varahadev can have what is called as Maushal Leela. Maushal Leela is the pastime of fighting. So, the conception of God, which is there in the Vedic Bhakti tradition, is actually a full depiction of God. God engages in all kinds of activities, and even engaging in all kinds of activities, He can manifest in a form of a boar, but still He remains transcendental. He can engage in fighting, and still He remains the source of all strength. And thus, when we understand how vivid, how attractive, how all-encompassing the conception of God is, then it is much easier to become attracted to Him. Whatever we find attractive in anyone in this world, yad vibhuti matsattvam shrimadurjitam evava tatta deva vagachattvam mamatejoamsa sambhava. Whatever we find attractive in this world, all attractive things and their attractiveness comes from Krishna. Say somebody is a champion bodybuilder. How is that person getting the strength from? That is that attractiveness, that strength which a person has, that comes from Krishna. Somebody is a cricketer who has millions of followers. What is the source of that cricketer's cricketing talent? That is coming from Krishna. Somebody is a brilliant actor, a very very good singer, whatever it is. Whatever anyone has attractive, their attractiveness comes from Krishna. Their attractiveness comes from Krishna, but their attractiveness may not take us to Krishna. if we watch a Bollywood movie, yes, the heroes, the heroines, they're attractive. Where does their attraction come from? Their attraction comes from Krishna. They have their beauty that is coming from Krishna. But Maya, the Bhagavatam defines as Rite Artham Yat Pratiyet Na Pratiyet Chatmani Tadvidyad Atmano Mayam Yatha Bhaso Yathatama. When we see anything as attractive, but we don't see its connection with Krishna, that is Maya. The seeing things as meaningful, but disconnected from Krishna, that is Maya. So, everything that is attractive in this world, its attraction comes from Krishna. But attraction to it may not take us to Krishna. We need to focus our attraction and cultivate attraction for those things which will attract us towards Krishna. So there are materialistic people who sing nicely. There are devotees who sing kirtans nicely. Now if we get attracted to music, we cannot just give up the attraction to music, but we can direct that attraction towards music, to devotional music. When we get attracted to that devotional music, then through that, our attraction to the attractive things of this world will connect us with the all attractive. If we do not connect with the all attractive, then there is some pleasure. Now we hear some movie song, we watch some movie, there is some pleasure there. But that pleasure is like a drop of water. Whereas Krishna is like an unlimited ocean of water, ocean of pleasure. So we cannot live without being attracted in this world. And present at our present level of consciousness, we do not immediately have access to the ocean of pleasure. We can have access only what is available at this material level of reality right now. So those drops which are actually connected with Krishna, so that music, that literature, that culture, those things which connect us with Krishna, which remind us of Krishna, when we become attracted to them, through them we can develop our attraction to Krishna, and thus we can relish eternal happiness in learning to love the one who is the source of unending happiness. So I'll summarize. I started by talking about the philosophical significance of Varahadev. That God, when somebody asks, does God exist? That means they don't understand what God is. God is the source of all existence. God is the basis of all existence. God is the one without whose existence nothing would exist. So the question, does God exist, is like asking, is a circle circular? So we need to, rather than answering the question, focus on helping people understand the definition. God is the cause of all causes. And even atheists cannot give a satisfactory explanation. They may not believe in God, but they cannot explain what is the cause of all causes. To say nothing, everything comes from nothing, they have to redefine nothing so that nothing is a lot of things. Then we discussed about how when God is eternal reality who exists beyond this world, and different people may conceive Him in different ways. And in different traditions, He's revealed in different ways. But the revelations in different traditions may not be equally complete. So we discussed about how there is polytheism, there is monotheism. That was the map that the Western world had. But the Vedic conception of God goes beyond this map. So we shouldn't reduce the conception of God to try to fit in this map. Oh, is this, you know, is Vaishnavism polytheistic, is this monotheistic? No, it is beyond this. It is what? Multi-level, polymorphic, bi-monotheism. So, we discussed how Krishna is transcendental, but He manifests in this world. God, the form of Varahadev, although the boar is considered not a particularly auspicious animal, but when Vishnu manifests as Varaha, the Varaha is not only just auspicious, He is associated with Yajna, which is the source of all auspiciousness in the Vedic culture. So God can exist, we discussed the story of God. God can exist even in stool, but He is not contaminated, remains transcendental. So God can manifest in any form, and He can still remain transcendental. Forms don't limit God, because God is not material. What limits things is matter. whether with form or without form. God has a form which is transcendental and which is unlimited. I discussed that God's infinitude is not mathematical, it is transcendental. To say that God cannot have a form, that we cannot know God, that is also a claim to knowing God. Then we discussed about Varahadev specifically, that it is not zoomorphism, it is the inclusiveness of the bhakti conception, that God can manifest in any form and still remain transcendental. So, Varahadev appeared because Hiranyaksha had destabilized the cosmic order. The Bhagavatam's cosmology is from a different scale of perception. So our observation depends on our scale of observation. We discussed the example of black coal and white chalk mixed together as grey powder. Now, when the Lord appeared, he fought and it appeared as if sometimes he was losing or he was having a tough fight. But eventually it was just a simple knockout, not even knockout blow, it was just a knockout touch. And he has finished him off. So, it is not that God is in a tough fight with evil. Rather, God is the source of the strength of even of evil. And when Krishna performs such pastimes in any of his avatars, that is simply to demonstrate, simply to perform Maushala Leela, to enjoy the joy of fighting. And through such activities, the Lord demonstrates how he is ultimately all attractive. And everything attractive in this world comes from Krishna, but it may not take us to Krishna. By remembering that this attractiveness is coming from Krishna, we can regulate our attraction to that and cultivate attraction to the one who is all attractive. By focusing on those attractive manifestations which remind us of him. And then our aspiration for love and happiness can be unlimitedly fulfilled in that Supreme Being who is the source of all love and all happiness. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna. So, does anyone have any questions? Okay, yes, friend. Yeah, you can just speak, I'll repeat.
Prabhuji, we observe that often for different purposes, even different forms of Vishnu are recommended to be worshipped. For example, when there were attacks in Mayapur, it was recommended that, you know, you should install Narasingadev.
Yeah.
And also in Shri Sampradaya and Madhva Sampradaya, it is recommended that for attaining or for getting scriptural knowledge, you should worship Hayagriva. So is it, what I wanted to understand, Prabhuji, is it that even the forms of Vishnu are in different moods? And if so, is it also not limiting the form? For example, if we have to...
Yeah.
So how can we understand that, Prabhuji?
So sometimes it's different forms are recommended to be worshipped for specific purposes, such as Narasimhadev for protection. So does, if different forms are in different moods, does that not limit the Lord to those particular moods? No, it's not limiting the Lord. It is the Lord manifesting in a particular way for particular kinds of reciprocation. It is not that Krishna cannot protect. Krishna can also protect. But Krishna himself does not directly involve himself as much in that activity as does another particular form. So, Krishna, if we see in Vrindavan, his pastimes are characterized by Bala Krida Kramiva. It is playful pastimes. Krishna does not use a single weapon ever in Vrindavan. All the demons, they are killed simply by acts of play. No weapons at all. Because that is not the mood of Vrindavan to use weapons. Why is that? Because Vrindavan is the abode of love. So now Krishna does use weapons elsewhere. But when devotees want protection, at particular times, we worship Narasimhadev because that is the form who is particularly focusing on protection. So it is not that Krishna cannot do this. Rather, Krishna manifests in a particular mood. And that mood is for intensifying a particular mood of reciprocation, a particular kind of emotion. So, any kind of reciprocation involves certain emphasis on certain things and accordingly de-emphasis on certain things. Now, if we start questioning every one of this, you know, when we say Krishna wears a peacock feather, okay, does that mean Krishna leaves only a peacock? Krishna doesn't love other birds? Doesn't that limit Krishna's love? Oh, Krishna wears a pitambar. That means Krishna likes only yellow color. That means Krishna doesn't like all other colors. Isn't the God partial then? No. We have to understand that God is a person. And a person means that he has his likes. He has his preferences. He has his moods. And those moods are different from our moods, our likes, because they are motivated simply by selfless love. So the devotee assists in those moods. And the Krishna, when he does something, the reciprocation, his particular personality manifests through particular actions. And when he manifests through those actions, those choices, those particular modes of living or acting or reciprocating, that makes his personality more vivid, more tangible, emotionally tangible, more ultimately lovable. Yadyad dhiyatu rugaya vibhavayanti, tattad vapuh pranyase sadanugrahaya. Brahmaji in his prayers for creative energy says, in the 9th chapter of the 3rd canto, in the 3rd canto basically says that, my dear Lord, whatever form a devotee desires to worship you in, you are so kind that you manifest in that form. That means, there is the Lord's desire, there is a devotee's desire. And the particular form of the Lord, and the particular reciprocation that happens in that form, that is meant for enhancing the love of both the Lord and the devotee. So the love essentially requires certain stimuli that enhance the love. The stimuli are present in the Lord, they evoke the devotee's love, and that's how the mood attains a further, the reciprocation of love, the loving emotion attains its zenith, it attains its culmination. So it's not a limitation, rather it's a facilitation for the intensification of love. Does that answer your question? Thank you. Yes, ma'am. Yeah.
Prabhuji, in the definition of bhakti, pure devotional service, there is this phrase, jnana karma dhanavritam. Can you just explain me each jnana and karma dhanavritam being uncovered by jnana and karma with an example and the difference between the two types of coverings?
Okay. So the definition of bhakti, jnana karma dhanavritam, it says, what does the uncovering actually mean? What does this whole phrase mean? Actually, jnana and karma are two basic faculties of every human being, or every living being, we could say, for that matter. Now, jnana connotes with knowledge, cognition. Karma connotes with action. So, you know, basically there are the hands, there is the head, there is the heart. So, karma is primarily the path of the hands. We do things in this world. Jnana is the path of the head. Where in jnana we focus, observe, what is the nature of this? What is the nature of this? What is the nature of this? Underlying the hands and the head, unifying it all is the heart. So bhakti is the process of the heart, but it is not the process of the heart alone. It is the process of the heart which engages the head and engages the hands also. So when we say jnana karmadi anavritam, what that means is that there is when the jnana and karma are covered, that means they are motivated by something other than pure love. So the covering is basically a misdirection. Now when there is white light, when it is covered by a red film, at that time the white light comes out as red. So now, similarly, the soul has the capacity for action, the soul has the capacity for cognition. But when there is lack of devotion, when there is misdirection of love from the Supreme towards anything else, then the capacity for action, the capacity for cognition are misdirected. They become not just misdirected, but they become motivated by something else. And that's the contamination. So the uncovering of these means that it's not that the bhakti rejects karma or bhakti rejects jnana. Devotees are active, devotees are also intellectual. They think, they have they study philosophy, they propagate philosophy also. But these are all subordinated to the love of the heart, they are harmonized. So, at one level, purification means removing that which is imposed. You know, from the world, there are so many impressions which have come upon us. And we try to remove those impressions. So, one conception of purification is that we remove that which has been imposed externally from us. So the impressions are removed. But another understanding of purification also is that that which is the innate nature and longing of the soul, that is activated. So purification has both aspects to it. So anavritam means currently our jnana and karma are both misdirected by the various conceptions and contamination that we have. So we remove those conceptions, we remove those contaminations. But after that, as the soul becomes, soul's nature to love and serve Krishna becomes activated, then jnana and karma become harmonized with that. So we see, for example, our acharyas, Shukdev Goswami, earlier he was from a monastic disposition. But when he understood how the all-attractive Supreme Person transcends the impersonal Brahman, then he used his phenomenal intelligence to compose and speak the Srimad Bhagavatam. So the jnana, which was avrita earlier, it became anavrita. That means he used the same knowledge that he had, but rather than using that knowledge to simply attain, understand impersonal Brahman, now he used it to glorify the personal Bhagavan. Similarly, karma, when we are materially minded, when our conceptions are material, at that time we use our capacity for action for material purposes. So there are many kings who would perform yajnas. That karma usually refers to some punya karma. So they would do various kinds of yajnas. This Prachini Barishad was a king who would do yajnas, but he had no conception of transcendence. Now the fourth canto is this guy, Prithu Maharaj, also doing yajnas. But when he was doing yajnas, he was not just remembering the particular devatas for whom the yajnas were performed, he was remembering Vishnu. And he was offering the fruits of that yajna to Vishnu. So the idea is, karma is not to be given up, jnana is not to be given up. Arjuna, for example, was going to do the karma of fighting, and he wanted to give it up. But Krishna told, don't give it up. He says, do it with a spiritual conception, do it with a spiritual motivation. So jnana karmadi anavritam means we have the capacity for action, we have the capacity for cognition, harmonize both of them with the purpose of devotion. That is jnana karmadi anavritam. Okay? Thank you. Any other questions? Yes, bro. Okay. Kinsey.
As a supreme, by word supreme itself, it can be only one, that cause of all causes is one. Then how we understand that by monotheism? Because you said these are the two souls and supreme.
Okay. So if God is supreme, how can God manifest as by monotheism? And if we say that Radha Krishna both are God, so how can both, supreme has to be one, how can they be two? Yeah, I explained that ek atma dui dehadhari. That there is one soul who is manifesting in two forms. So it is, when we say Krishna and Radha, they are not two persons, actually speaking. They are one person who manifests in two forms. So, when we say that, okay, there are many gods and some, that's polytheism, that different gods will fight with each other. Now, the idea is that the two are independent realities. And they are independent persons, and they have their independent wills, and they fight with each other. But when you talk about Radha Krishna, you know, they, within the Leela, they act as two distinct persons. But even when Radharani manifests a contrary bhav, you know, sometimes she appears to be angry with Krishna, and she doesn't want to talk with Krishna. You know, she is doing that for the pleasure of Krishna. So there is, it is not that Radharani is, when I say Radharani is, Radharani and Krishna are one and are the same one person manifesting as two, that does not mean that Radharani is not a distinct person. For the purpose of Leela, the whole spiritual world and everything that is manifested in the spiritual world is for the purpose of Leela. And the underlying unifying reality within Leela is prema, is love. So everything that is manifest there is for love. If we understand God through the framework of Tattva, and we understand God through the framework of Leela. And if we don't understand this progressively, then there can be a lot of confusion. Krishna steals butter. Now stealing is a crime. How can God commit a crime? And you know, if you want to commit a crime also, you know, steal something valuable. Why steal butter of all things? So actually, from the tattva point of view, first we need to philosophically understand Krishna is God. And Krishna, He is God, He is the source of everything. He is the source of all butter also. So He doesn't have to steal butter. But within Leela, whatever is required for the reciprocation of love, for the intensification of love, He does. So Krishna acts like a mischievous child. And as a mischievous child, you know, what will increase the love of His devotees for Him, especially those devotees are in the maternal mood. That is, when He acts in a mischievous way, He steals butter. So He steals butter not because He's a thief, nor does He steal butter because He's hungry, nor does He steal butter specifically because, you know, He doesn't understand the value of things. No, He steals butter because that is the way He will reciprocate love with His devotees. So, Radharani is also Krishna, but she takes on a particular role for the reciprocation of love. And she acts as a different person, and she sometimes acts in a way which is pleasing to Krishna when she submits to His will, and sometimes she pleases Krishna by not submitting to His will. So that reciprocation of love is the fundamental reality. And that reciprocation of love is what we need to focus on. If, you know, if we try to look at the action without understanding the position, then that leads to confusion. So for example, if a person who is a tribal who doesn't know anything about surgery, that person comes to a hospital. And in the hospital they say that, you know, okay, this person is sick. And then this person, you know, he takes out a knife and he starts cutting the stomach of a person. Hey, he's killing, stop him. And other people say, hey, don't disturb. Then the relatives, and then he observes this relative, hey, he's killing your son, killing your relative. He says, doesn't pay any attention. Not only the relatives don't pay any attention, after the person he cuts up the stomach, the relatives go and pay the person. Say, what is going on? He says, but the problem is, he is looking at the action without understanding the position. Normally cutting is a crime. But this is a surgeon. Surgeon when cuts to heal. So similarly, when we understand, look at Krishna, if we try to understand Krishna's action without understanding His position, that will lead to confusion. So we need to understand the philosophy and then understand the pastimes. Okay? Thank you. Yes, Prabhu.
Hare Krishna, Prabhu. Nanu Pranam. Usually in science, whenever we are looking for any knowledge regarding God, we are actually looking for through experience or through facts, verifiable experimental facts. But in spirituality, we are actually looking for knowledge from Shabda Praman, and science does not usually accept that. So is there any other way, or is it that to experience spiritual knowledge of God, we always have to look through Shabda Praman? Because science is actually looking for something realizable in terms of experience or in facts or reproducible.
Okay. So science looks for facts in order to get reliable, verifiable knowledge. But for God and spirituality, we rely on Shabda Praman. So is there any way we can acquire knowledge about God in a way that science can accept? There are two different points over here. One is the method of acquiring knowledge, and the second is the reality of what knowledge is acquired. So science, when we acquire knowledge through science, at one level, science seems to give us knowledge of reality. Now, Newton observed a fruit falling and he tried to postulate, what is the cause of that? Why did this fruit fall? And he came up with the principle of gravity. But you see over here, science began, when we talk about science, people say science depends on, science talks about facts. But what do we mean by facts? Now, are we talking about tangible, touchable, visible, real things? If that is what we are talking about, then science actually progresses by moving from the visible to the invisible. The visible was what? Newton observed the fruit falling. But from that he postulated something invisible. That is the principle of gravity. And in fact the whole progress of knowledge happens by, in any field we take it, it is moving from, in science also, we move from visible specifics to universal, to invisible principles. Science progresses like that. And in fact, you know, if instead of Newton there had been a monkey who had observed the fruit falling, The monkey would just have eaten the fruit and gone away. Isn't it? So, Pashu, animal is called as Pashu. And Pashu, one of the etymologies of Pashu is Pashyati iti Pashu. One who relies on seeing too much. One who over relies on visual perception, that is a Pashu. So even scientific knowledge cannot be acquired if we insist on seeing is believing. When science actually moves from the visible to the invisible. Now, there are three modes of acquiring knowledge. There is Pratyaksha Praman, there is Anuman Praman, there is Shabda Praman. In terms of modern modes of acquiring knowledge, there is Pratyaksha Praman is empiricism. Anuman Praman is rationalism. So empiricism means we focus on empirical visible realities. Rationalism means there is mode of reasoning and thinking. And by that we acquire knowledge. So in classical Newtonian physics, empiricism and rationalism were married together. Both of them were going together. But at the turn of the 20th century, when the black body radiation was discovered and the source of gravity, where was it coming from? Those unanswered questions, they were answered through the development of quantum physics on one side and the development of relativity physics on the other side. And these basically caused a divorce between empiricism and rationalism. So, for example, relativity focuses on things as they exist. You know, we see particles, we see objects. And how do those objects move about? That is what relativity tries to explain. So, relativity basically begins with observed reality and then tries to have theories that explain the observed reality. Quantum physics begins primarily with mathematics, begins with theory. And then it looks for the coherence of the theory, it looks for the accuracy of the mathematics. And it focuses on rationalism. Rationalism means theoretical coherence. How rationally, mathematically, logically, reasonably intelligible it is. But the result of this is quantum physics comes up with a worldview which we can't view. That means, you know, quantum physics basically says everything is just waves. And Einstein himself was exasperated with the worldview that emerged from quantum physics. One of his most famous quotes critiquing quantum physics is, he says that, you know, if everything, quantum physics is complex, but the point is that quantum physics says everything depends on, there is no such thing as this wall existing. There is no such thing as ceiling existing. When I look at it, you know, the wave collapses into a perception of a wall. So now, Einstein said, you know, I would like to believe that the moon continues to exist even if I am not looking at it. Isn't it? So what he means, actually quantum physics implies that if I am not looking at it, the moon doesn't exist. It is just basically a wave which collapses. I am using very simple language over here. These are technical subjects. The point I am making, when I am saying I am using simple language, I am just making broad statements that, so quantum physics basically focuses on, it just says that what you see doesn't matter. So quantum physics rejects anuma, rejects pratyaksha and focuses only on anuman. And it tries to say if you cannot harmonize with pratyaksha, then just reject pratyaksha. So as long as the theory makes sense, there's a famous mathematician, you know, one of his students, he came and asked him, physicist, basically quantum physicist, he asked him, sir, this quantum physics, how do I visualize it? How do I perceive this world? He says, shut up and calculate. So he says, you know, as long as the maths works, it's fine. So the problem now is that quantum physics and relativity, these two are two very different ways of looking at the world. They are not just different, they are contradictory. According to quantum physics, you know, the world is made simply of waves. According to relativity, it is actually made of particles. Now, what is it actually? Since the 1920s, 1930s, researchers have been trying to find out whether a science author who wrote a book of basically the story of the history of science over the 20th century. And the title of the book he gave is, From Certainty to Uncertainty. From Certainty to Uncertainty. So what has happened is, previously scientists thought that we are acquiring knowledge of reality. When we study, we are acquiring knowledge of reality. But now this conflict between quantum physics and relativity is so great. And Steven Weinberg is a prominent atheist. He said that, you know, by the turn of the 20th century, in 1980s he said, by the turn of the 20th century, you know, we will have answers to all the questions of how quantum physics and relativity are to be reconciled. But by the 20th century, he said, we have made great progress, but the more progress we have made, the more we have understood how big the problem is. So the more quantum physics has advanced, the more relativity has advanced, the more the difference between the two has become bigger and bigger. So Stephen Hawking, he also in 2004, he said, you know, he just gave up. He said, he gave up, but he concealed his in a typical spin doctoring way. He said, I'm happy to announce that humanity's quest for knowledge will never end. What that means is we'll stay in ignorance. Basically, so the point is, scientists now, if you look at them, they basically say that science is not a quest for knowledge of reality. Science is basically a quest for knowledge of correlations between observed features of reality. So quantum physics offers a certain kind of correlations, and relativity offers a certain kind of correlations. So science is basically offering us a map of reality. Quantum physics offers us one kind of map which is useful in one way. Relativity offers us another kind of map which is useful in another way. But those two maps just don't match. And what is the reality that they are mapping, that is completely out of our scope. That is just, you know, it is just, scientists are just, most scientists say that they don't talk about reality only. So science basically gives us a model of reality. It does not give us a reality. And that model depends on which kind of theory which we are using. So just like if I have India, I can have a physical map of India which describes, okay, here there is a hill, there is a mountain, here there is this, there is rivers. That's one kind of map. Then I can have a political map of India where this is Maharashtra, this is Karnataka, this is Madhya Pradesh. So the different maps have different focuses. But suppose we use a map. Suppose, you know, say I have to go from here to Pune to meet a friend. And I take a map and I find that the map is precise. You know. Okay, it tells go here, you'll come to a bridge, then you'll come to a river, then you go left, then you come. Every single landmark that it gives is fine. It works very well. And then finally I reach Pune, I knock on my friend's door, and my friend opens the door and he says, oh, welcome. And I look at my map. He says, you don't exist in the map. Therefore, you don't exist. Now my friend will say, your intelligence doesn't exist. Isn't it? You know, I'm not meant to be there in the map. So the map gives us something which is connected with reality. But the map is not an exhaustive depiction of reality. So, now, why I'm talking about all this is, that the map is describing physical features. It does not describe people. So like that, when science starts studying reality, it begins by focusing on matter and material things. And that which is non-material is left out of the map. So we as conscious beings are not there in the map of science. We're just not there in that map. So what we need to do is, spirituality and science, they are not contradictory. They are basically having different focuses. So if we consider spiritual knowledge or scriptural knowledge to be like a big circle, within that there will be one sector which agrees with science, there will be one sector which disagrees with science. But there's a huge section which is actually beyond science. So beyond science means that science just can't address issues which are non-material. So our focus in studying scripture is primarily to experience that non-material reality. So can spirituality offer us something which can be verified by science? See, by definition itself, spirituality is beyond matter. And science focuses on matter. But there is a field that is the area of the mind. You know, the mind is matter, but it is subtle matter. Spirit is transcendental. Now, science itself is finding it very difficult to deal with the mind. The biggest health crisis in today's world is mental health problems. And although psychiatry is trying to deal with it, often very perplexing, because what is the mind is not understandable. So at the level of the mind, when there is tangible transformation that happens. Now people, they're irritable, they become peaceful. People have uncontrolled emotion, their emotions become calmed down. Martin Luther King had said that our scientific power has outrun our spiritual power. Talked about modern society. Our scientific power has outrun our spiritual power. We have guided missiles and misguided men. So what that means is that science is offering us a particular kind of knowledge which is very powerful in particular ways. But the current frame of science does not allow anything non-material to be introduced in it. And that's why to try to prove God or soul through the current frame of reference of science is trying to show a color picture through a black and white TV. It's intrinsically impossible. But what can be done is the frontiers of science can be expanded. That means, does science necessarily have to stick to material reality? That is not necessary. The conceptions of science, the definition of science can be expanded. And that requires a lot of work. So when we talk about bhakti, it is a spiritual science. It is not a material science. Spiritual science means, this is, in bhakti, the experiment is on the consciousness. The experiment is an experience. And when we, by the process of bhakti, we ourselves become purified, we ourselves become transformed. Transformed in a way that people can appreciate. What people ask, what makes you tick? Scientists are also not just unidimensional experiment performers. Scientists are also human beings. And they also want to become better human beings. Scientifically minded people also, they see we are human beings, we can use science as a source of knowledge, we can use spirituality as a source of knowledge. Whichever empowers us to become better. So today technology is showing that science, technology is showing how there are better ways in which we can control the outer world. And people are attracted by that. But through spirituality, if we demonstrate that spirituality empowers us to control the inner world, and then we demonstrate ourselves as transformed people, we become transformed and we share that process of transformation with others, that is also scientific. Scientific not in the sense that it can be empirically demonstrated. It's not in terms of experiments can be done as controlled experiments in a scientific laboratory. Rather, it is something which is verifiable. It is something which is repeatable. It is something which is reasonable. So that way we can offer, in the expanded sense of science, in the transformation of individual beings, we can offer something which people, even scientifically minded people and even scientists can appreciate. And then they can become open to the transforming power of spirituality. Okay, thank you. Any one last question? So thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki.
Hare Krishna.